As always, I'm your host, Maxwell Cody, and joining me today is a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, Extremely Online, Taylor Lorenz, also known as Taylaws to her fans. How's it going, Taylor?
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Can we get a little biography? Can we start there? Where are you from? Who are you? For people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. My name is Taylor Lorenz. Obviously, I'm a technology reporter at The Washington Post. I have been a reporter for several years. I cover technology and online culture, like TikTok, YouTubers, stuff like that. I have been a journalist for over a decade. I started reporting on all this stuff in 2009. I'm from New York City originally, and then lived in Connecticut, went to college in Colorado, mostly lived in New York. Now I live in LA. And that's about it.
So you are,
I have a book coming out this fall.
Yes. I mean, I always try, anytime I have a book person on, I try to get the book out of the way first. Otherwise, it gets forgotten and I feel bad about it. So tell
yes,
us about the book.
You can pre-order it now. I'm so sorry. I think there's a delay actually on the audio. I'm so sorry for interrupting you.
It's okay.
My book comes out this fall. It's called Extremely Online, The Untold Story of Fame, Influence, and Power on the Internet. And you can pre-order it now. Pre-orders are like the only thing that matters for books. So yeah, it's about the rise of the influencer industry, and it's kind of a like a social history of the rise of social media over the past 20 years.
That's what I was a little surprised by, because you sent me an excerpt and I'm reading it and I'm like, Vine, Gamergate, this was 100 years ago. So was the point of this book, was it to kind of maybe bring the boomers up to speed a little bit on what's happened in the last, well, it's been about 1,000 years on internet time, but in last 20 years in actual time.
Yeah. I know a lot of the book focuses on, you know, the early 2010s and the aughts. So truly like the earliest days of social media, from like MySpace stars to like mommy bloggers to, yeah, as you mentioned, a bunch about Vine. I mean, it's kind of to like set the record straight on a lot of stuff. I mean, no one's really written, there's been a lot of like corporate histories of like the history of Instagram from a corporate perspective, or the history of Facebook obviously has been written a lot, or YouTube, but those are sort of just these corporate narratives that are focused around companies. And I wanted to write about sort of from the user side, how did this whole sort of like content creator industry emerge? Who shaped it? Who really pioneered it? What were the companies that, that built this business and really changed the internet? So I think it's actually like, I don't know, I had a Gen Z copy editor, actually like edit it, and he couldn't remember a lot of stuff, because I think even like those of us who have been adults on the internet and or on the internet our whole lives, like sort of forget about what it was really like in like 2010, for instance, or like, you know, when Instagram launched, and like, yeah, what happened when Vine shut down. So
for people who don't remember, for people who for whom it was before their time, I mean, what was Gamergate?
Yeah. Well, Gamergate was this like, oh God, it's so funny, because it's like I struggle so hard to describe it to people that don't understand it, because it was a movement in 2014-ish, I guess, that was against, it was sort of this like backlash towards progressive ideals in gaming. People were kind of like mad. I mean, it's funny because now that stuff is so commonplace. You'll see people like, oh, I hate the woke character on whatever. But people were sort of, it was just this like hate campaign against women in gaming, perpetuated mainly by these like weird online communities that were like really angry about specific women games journalists.
that would be the official version of it. I mean, I remember observing Gamergate as it happened. And to this day, I'm not really sure what it was about. And I feel like I was there. I was watching it. This is when I was like beginning to consume all of this internet blood sports and endless commentary content that's kind of become the norm today, right? But the argument that the aggrieved side of Gamergate, or the aggrieved male side of Gamergate, was that you had a certain game developer who was in a relationship with a man who was reviewing her game and giving her positive reviews. And they felt like this was a sign of corruption in the industry. And then from there, it kind of spiraled, like everything into a culture war thing.
Yeah. I don't think it was very like cut and dry at all. And also like, it wasn't really about games. I'm with you. I mean, I lived through it very sort of directly and know a lot of people involved. And I think it was like, you know, games were sort of like a proxy for sort of a lot of frustration that came out. You know what I mean? Like, I totally agree with you. Like, it wasn't, I don't know, people love to be like, no, it's about ethics and game journalism. Like, no, it's not. Yeah. I think like there was just a lot of kind of like pissed off people, some for good reason, like some legitimate critiques and a lot not legitimate critiques of just kind of like anger bubbling up on the internet. And it's so, I'm kind of curious of your thoughts too, because I feel like nowadays, like these kind of waves of like anger on the internet, like come and go like every 2 seconds. But that was like one of the first times it like broke into the mainstream, I guess, where people were like, oh my God, like, why are all these people mad on the internet? And now it's just like every day someone's mad about, you know, some new dumb bullshit.
Here's what I always go back to this. I don't know if you remember hashtag Star Wars is white genocide. Do you remember hashtag Star Wars is white genocide?
Yes.
So like I remember. I think before Force Awakens, the most recent Star Wars reboot. It was right before Force Awakens came out. People getting very excited about it. And all of a sudden, you know, I go on the internet and I believe at that point we were living in a post Gamergate world. And I see all this stuff about Star Wars is white genocide, Star Wars is white genocide. There's movement online saying Star Wars is white genocide. Every time I'm checking, it's trending. And now John Boyega is issuing an official response. Disney is issuing an official response. There's all these stories about it. So I go looking, I go digging, and eventually what I find out is that Star Wars is White Genocide was started, if I remember correctly, it was two bot accounts on Twitter that were just tweeting that every 15 minutes. And that was it.
Yeah.
That's all it took, was probably one person who was like, time to troll, and they make a little Twitter bot, and all it has to say is one inflammatory thing connected to one popular pop cultural event, and that's all it takes. And the thing is, it's not that there aren't racists on the internet, or, you know, obviously it's not that. It's not that those people aren't out there. It's just that it seems like there's this, I don't know if I want to call it symbiotic or parasitic, but there's this relationship that the mainstream, quote unquote, media has with sensationalism. And then there's kind of an online culture that can take advantage of that very easily. And I think the two end up kind of feeding into each other.
I totally agree. Also, I think it was like 2015 when that happened, but that was like peak, like, let's just write up everything that's trending, you know, like this is trending. And then like, you know, those articles where it's like the internet claps back or whatever. And then they just like quote like five random accounts that you're not even sure are real. It's like, what is this, like actual discourse or not? Like, yeah. It's a good example of that. I think Gamergate was sort of like the beginning of that. It's not a big part of my book or anything. My book is funny because my editor was like, we need to mention Gamergate, you know, like, because it was this pivotal moment. It's just like, yeah, it's just hard. I mean, you could write like a whole book about this type of stuff. And sort of the way, I do think it showed the ways the internet could be weaponized, because prior to Gamergate, I mean, it's hard to remember, but people were just like, drinking the Kool-Aid about Facebook and Twitter, and like everyone was like, these are amazing tools that are going to bring democracy to the world and spread the joy of whatever, you know. And like, and then I think people started to be like, oh my God, there's actually hate on the internet and these places can be weaponized. And so yeah, it was kind of a turning like point, that era.
I mean, I remember being, you know, 13, 14, going on the internet seriously for the first time. And I always understood that these subcultures existed. Because in my view, you couldn't really avoid them if you tried. But I also remember reading an article about how it was when Twitter was first coming out. And I wish I had saved this article. But it was about how Twitter was going to basically be a spiritual experience. Like it was going to become this beautiful collective consciousness for us to all share in. And it's funny how poorly it is funny how poorly that's aged. But before I forget, or before I get off this point, you know, I still to this day believe that if the media had simply ignored Donald Trump's infamous "they're not sending their best Mexico" comments, if they had simply blown that off or even laughed it off, I don't think he ever would have become president. I think it's like it was like Gamergate, but on a much larger scale. Or Star Wars is white genocide on a much larger scale, where the media can't help but take the bait. And in doing so, I think they end up just amplifying and helping to create the thing for them to continue to get outraged about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the media, I covered the 2016 election. Like that was my full-time job, was in politics at a political publisher then, and I was on the campaign trail and everything. And yeah, the media, I mean, Trump himself is such a media creation, just in terms of like his entire brand and personality. He's extremely good at
he's TV incarnate. Yeah.
Yeah. At like, you know, getting attention, and especially mainstream attention. I think the mainstream media also just doesn't understand broadly how to deal with people like Trump, who I kind of consider, like, I mean, to me, he has like YouTuber energy in the sense of like, he'll just sort of do anything and say ridiculous things. And you can't cover a person like that without like understanding kind of the ridiculousness of it, I guess. I don't know. I mean, he was just so good at like triggering people into writing about him and giving him more attention and more credibility.
But
so who knows what would have happened.
But in your own coverage of these movements and of these things, do you ever feel like you have accidentally amplified or helped these people?
Not really. I mean, I'm trying to think back to like 2016. I mean, sure, probably. But I wasn't producing those articles. Like I wasn't writing like, oh my God, like Trump, whatever, whatever. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I wrote up so much trending news. I probably wrote up a Trump tweet or two at some point. But I mean, I think my coverage is more focused on the, like, I mean, it would have to have like news relevance. So I don't really do that kind of like reactive breaking news coverage. Unfortunately, the people that are doing that are like 22-year-old breaking news reporters that just have to write up every trending thing, because that's what gets clicks. And especially in 2016, that's what was getting Facebook traffic, which was a huge goal for media companies at the time. So it's not like, you know, sure, there are some like, you know, big time reporters at the New York Times doing dumb shit like that. But like most of that kind of like low level content is, it's just like people that are doing hourly work. And eventually I think it's going to be replaced by AI. But yeah, and Facebook played a huge role, because Facebook was juicing traffic towards those Trump articles. So media companies were just like incentivized to do zillions of them.
Well, what I was getting frustrated with is there was so much talk about Russian interference, Russian infiltration, you know, Russians trying to run psyops with Facebook. And the thing is, okay, once again, it is true. It is true that Russia was playing games on Facebook. That is true. But not all of the Russian disinfo in the world was going to help Donald Trump more than just one angry liberal on TV. And all there was, all the coverage of Trump ever is liberal tears and liberals being outraged and liberals slamming their hand on the desk. And they don't realize every time they do that, the Trump machine gets a little bit bigger. The wall gets a little bit higher every time that happens. And that was way more powerful, way more persuasive to Trump's demographics, to Trump's base, than any amount of Russian interference.
Yeah, definitely. And to be clear, when I talk about Facebook, I mean Facebook, like the actual Facebook algorithm, not like some Russian Facebook page or whatever.
Yes, which of course, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, totally. I mean, I think also, like, I mean, I am a very vocal hater of cable news, but like, I think it's the worst. It's sort of like combines all of these like worst tendencies. I don't know if you remember, but like 2016, it was just wall to wall. Like these cable news channels could not get enough. It was boosting their ratings, and you had the outraged, you know, boomers just glued to their TVs. So yeah, it's bad. It's like liberal outrage, which just translates into nonstop mainstream media coverage.
Well, but if you had to say, I mean, so maybe to bring it back to the book, if you had to choose between legacy media and its problems or online media and its problems, influencer-based media, we might say, I mean, which do you think is worse?
Oh God. Well, I don't want to live in a world where like either is 100% dominant. I'm a big
Okay.
believer in independent media. I if you look at like the 90s, you know, when legacy media was king, I mean, that's the world that we grew up in. I think it's corrosive and bad and, you know, toxic. That said, I work in traditional media, and I can't believe I work in traditional media because I was so anti-traditional media, and I started as a blogger. And I like now that I've worked at these institutions, like I think that there's actually like enormous value in having a place that has the resources to do hardcore investigative journalism, like actual investigative journalism. And that just doesn't happen on YouTube and stuff as much. I mean, you have great people like CoffeeZilla who does like, you know, fraud investigations and stuff. You do have a few people, but it's really few and far between because it's so hard to sustain, you know, monetarily. It's same with Substack. It's like it's you don't you can't be doing independent investigative journalism on these platforms to the level that you can in, you know, with the backing of certain outlets. So,
Okay.
you know, do I want to? Yeah, I wouldn't eliminate either. I would love to live in a world where we have a lot more independent journalism. But I also think like I don't want to like eliminate ProPublica or whatever, you know, like I don't think all legacy news is bad.
I
I think it's
remember being,
important in a lot of ways.
I, you know, well, I get a lot of people telling me, well, you don't believe the mainstream media, right? And normally I want to say yes, but then I know the implication is that, you know, don't believe the mainstream media, do believe whatever random algorithmically generated list of alternative quote unquote media sources that I'm into, that sort of thing. And I'm like, that's not necessarily better, right? Trading the mainstream media for a string of randos that kind of were put in front of you because they know that you're predisposed to believing in them anyway, that sort of thing. These little algorithm bubbles that people live in, basically.
Oh yeah, it's so bad. I mean, people just believe everything, and a lot of those people are getting their content from the mainstream media and just putting their own spin on it. Like, you know, there's just so much sort of like commentary. And I love it. I watch a lot of it, but a lot of it's like the source material itself that they're commenting on, you know, some investigation or whatever, big news that's been revealed, that's been revealed by some big traditional media organization. So, I mean, I do think it's really important to preserve investigative journalism and, you know, scrutinize power and all of that. But I also hear the critiques of corporate media, and I think we need to revamp the media landscape, but certainly not live in a world that's only dominated by like TikTok news commentators.
Well, two things. One, I wanted to ask you just about the idea of objectivity, because something that has disturbed me a little bit in recent years is, and maybe this is just me, but it seems like it's gotten popular to say that there is no objectivity. Well, because everybody's opinion is
Yeah.
equal, and I have as much right to my feelings as you do. It's gotten more and more solipsistic, and you know, as a journalist, you're supposed to say absolutely not. There must be some standards, right? There must be some standards, and if we have
Well,
journalistic standards for mainstream media, we have to apply those standards to everyone online as well, right?
yeah. I mean, when people say there's no such thing as objectivity, what they're talking about is the fact that no person, there's no one, like every person comes to a story with their own, like background and experience. Like there's no, what they're saying is that there's no one universal experience. Like every person, you know, has a level of knowledge or personal experience with the things that they're writing about, and that absolutely informs how they cover specific issues. It's like if some person is just going in to a story, like, you know, if I was to suddenly write about, who the fuck knows, I don't know, some like random topic that I don't know any sewing or something. I don't know anything about sewing. I'm coming into it blind. I'm writing a story on it, whatever. I'm going to write a very different story than someone that is a, you know, seamstress for 40 years and that's their entire life and passion. Like they're going to write it, you know. So I think like that's what people mean when they say there's no objectivity. It's like there's no one universal experience. And there used to be. It used to be really only one type of person making the news, which was straight cis like white guys. Like that was just like the newspaper man. Like that's who made the news. Now there's a whole range of people of socioeconomic backgrounds, racial backgrounds, you know, different genders, whatever, which I think is good. I mean, obviously that's a better, more representative news ecosystem and like great. But we should still strive for the truth. Like I think when people hear like, oh, there's no such thing of objectivity, they think like there's no such thing as the truth. Like everyone can kind of live in their own truth and their own reality. And that's just not true. Like, I mean, there are things that are objectively true and false. And I think that's the job of the reporter is to get to the truth of something. It doesn't really matter. You know, yes, you can bring your experiences and your background and your knowledge of topics to whatever you're writing about, but your goal should be to inform readers and educate them and, you know, explain to them what the truth of the matter is.
That is a very generous reading. And I actually hope that you are correct. Because the way I see it is that opinionism, as I like to call it, is superseding journalism and maybe superseded journalism 20 years ago. And we just didn't really know it. Where, you know, everything is being situated around subjectivity because everyone experiences everything through this very isolated, voyeuristic experience of the screen.
Sorry, the delay is so hard. I feel like I'm interrupting you.
It's no problem. It's no problem.
I would say if you read articles, even from like, you know, the 80s or 90s, they're highly subjective, like crazy. It's crazy. Like this, like the framing on certain stories. I don't know. I was just rereading a bunch of stuff about the AIDS crisis and like the way that this stuff is written is like, it's borderline. I mean, it is opinion. It's basically opinion pieces in the news sections of the New York Times. It's just that the opinions were all sort of universally from the same type of person. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of knew what to expect, I guess. And I think that journalism is always, you know, it's a subjective job. And even just the choice in stories that you decide to pursue is highly subjective.
Okay. Let me tell you about a little pet peeve of mine. A little pet hatred I have that I pet all the time. The New York Times very much helped push the idea that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Yes.
To me, in my opinion, that should have been it for the New York Times when that turned out to be completely false. Should have been it for the Bush administration as well. Somehow, this massive conspiracy theory farce was simply memory hold. It doesn't even get talked about anymore. People don't even remember that this happened. And yet at the same time, okay, you have somebody like Alex Jones, who I can even agree did some harm, but he's being fined billions of dollars for defamation, where, I mean, comparatively, the amount of damage that he did is nothing compared to the amount of damage that the New York Times did. When it's one angry individual who kind of becomes unpopular, he's the one who gets squashed. When it's a big institution that contributes to a phony war or a war based on false pretext that kills hundreds of thousands of people, well, oops, just forget about it.
It's so disgusting to me that there's no, there's no reconciliation with the harms, you know, that a lot of these mainstream institutions have done. And I don't think that they'll ever get what they deserve. You know, I think it's horrifying. It's not just the Iraq war. I mean, if you look at some of the misinformation that, you know, a lot of these big legacy media places have pushed over the years, it's horrifying. And we should have some sort of like public discussion of that. It's extremely frustrating because anytime you try and point that out or have a conversation, you have people saying, oh, you know, oh, so you don't believe in journalism. It's like, well, what you did at that point was not journalism. It was pushing an agenda. I mean, mm-hmm. The New York Times, and by the way, I worked at the New York Times for years, the New York Times morning newsletter, you know, Politico wrote a great story a couple years ago about how, you know, dozens of, I think it was actually hundreds of doctors and medical experts had written to the New York Times. And I was there when this happened because I know people in the newsroom called it as well, saying that they were pushing misinformation in their morning newsletter about COVID. And, you know, Politico wrote this great story. There was tons of discussion at the time. People at the New York Times were like, you need to stop pushing this opinion nonsense as news to 15 million people every morning. Nothing happened. Nothing changed. Nothing. And there will never be any kind of recognition of the harms that they did with that. So this happens constantly. I think those of us that work in the mainstream media, like, need to be better about calling it out. It's just that the problem is exactly like you mentioned, these are huge institutions, huge, powerful institutions in our country. And yeah, there will never be any sort of like, I'm trying to think of the word, but like, there'll never be any like look back and be like, that was a real mistake. How can we never, you know, make sure that never happens again? I mean, maybe certain people at the paper will think of that, but the people in power are still in power. You know, it's disappointing. And that doesn't mean that we should disregard the work of all of these places and consider them untrustworthy. I think that these things happening over and over every year, I think it just shows that like why people are gravitating towards individuals, because it's much easier to know, okay, I can trust this individual reporter versus I can just trust this whole institution, which has traditionally gotten actually a lot of stuff wrong, if that makes sense.
Can we talk about COVID a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
Because to me, very early on in the pandemic, it was glaringly obvious to me that COVID had leaked from a lab, that it had not come about through bat eating, and that the fact that this virus started right next to a virology lab was something that needed to be looked into. And I got a lot of shit for it. I mean, people were acting like some people in my life who were, we'll say, left of center liberals, they were acting like I was a heinous monster for even entertaining this idea or talking about it at all. And now we got a U.S. intelligence report saying that people who worked at the Wuhan lab were being treated for COVID in November 2019. It looks pretty conclusive now to me that what was obvious from the beginning was the case all along, and that this should not have been a partisan issue, but it was made a partisan issue. It was something that was basically treated like a third rail because it was an election year. If we talk about misinformation about COVID, for a long time, anything talking about lab leak was labeled misinformation. And now all of a sudden, not so sure.
Yeah, I think that whole discussion shows the problems of these tech platforms determining what is and isn't misinformation. I wrote a piece for the Washington Post just last year about Twitter, labeling a lot of completely factual information about COVID as misinformation. This is pre-Elon Musk. So I think it's really hard. I think we're living in this period where every little piece of news gets contentious, it gets politicized, there's a narrative about something, and we just outright dismiss things, or we people get a narrative in their head. They say, oh, well, Biden said XYZ, or some, you know, person in power told me XYZ, and that is it. And I'm going to believe that. And the truth is always more nuanced. Like, there's always just, you know, often the truth is more nuanced, I would say, like, especially on these big complicated issues. And I think they deserve a lot more scrutiny. I think there's no way that we will know the answer to something as difficult to answer as where this virus came from, you know, immediately. And I think that the way that tech companies handle these types of things can end up inflaming these questions of truth even more, because, you know, once you slap a misinformation label on something without context, it almost makes people angry, right? And then they're like, well, what about, but it could be true, right? Or we actually don't know enough, or whatever, or it's actually a point of scientific debate. Like, so I think things like community notes on Twitter are a step in the right direction, although I think that system is highly flawed as well. but I don't know. I mean, I think we're all kind of working out like how to get reliable information. And I don't know that any of these big tech companies should be the arbiters of truth. I mean, I actually think they shouldn't, because they don't have a great history in determining this stuff either. That said, I think there are legitimate conspiracy theories that can be very dangerous. My feeling on all of this stuff is that we just need better media literacy. I don't think that these problems are going to be fixed by some big corporation coming in and being like, you can't talk about that because that's false or whatever. Like, I think that we all in this country have, like, I mean, there's basically zero media literacy in this country. And I think if we all had a better, more sophisticated understanding of the news environment and who we're getting our news from, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems. Most people can't even distinguish the difference between opinion and fact. Like, they'll read an opinion article and they don't even know that it's opinion. So that's why they consume so much commentary content, believing it's reporting.
But when I talk about death of objectivity, I mean, I think you kind of just hit the nail on the head with what I mean.
Totally. No, I do think that we have a crisis in that point. I guess for death of objectivity, when people say that phrase, I think of it the way that like journalism people write think pieces about it. But okay, well, I do think that we enough. Have, I do think that there's no one. Yeah. I do think that there's no one collective reality that we all live in now. And we used to, because we all consumed mass media and we all basically bought whatever mass media was telling us. Like, there was only a few newspapers and TV stations and stuff. So there was this monoculture, and we don't have a monoculture anymore.
Speaking of Twitter, you are still kicked off of Twitter, correct?
I'm back.
Oh, you're back.
But I don't really use it very much. Yeah, I got back on. I had to delete my tweet that violated terms, which was promoting my Instagram account. So funny. Elon banned me in December, but I am. I like it. I mean, I'll sign up for anything with a login page, but it's fine. It's fun. I like people on Instagram better than I like people on Twitter. Not like the norm. Like, I think there's cool, funny people on Instagram that don't have Twitter. And so I like threads.
I'm fairly certain people are a little meaner on Twitter than they are on Instagram. And I'm not sure why.
The energy of Twitter.
Explanation I could come up with is that because Instagram is more picture oriented than Twitter, obviously, because Twitter is more text oriented. When you actually have to see somebody's face, maybe, or you can see pictures of them, even if it's not actual pictures of them, maybe that tickles something in our brain that makes us a little bit more pro-social. That's the only explanation I could come up with. But
I think that's true. I mean, Instagram also has much stricter community guidelines, which, you know, I don't love, to be honest. But, you know, they do have a different set of rules on Instagram.
So how did you get extremely online? I mean, did you try? I know you kind of, have you ever made any memes? I know you have a page on Instagram now. I think you post a lot of stuff. I mean, you're taught, beyond objectivity, I mean, how did you get into character for this book?
Yeah. I've made memes. I mostly repost other memes, but I mean, sometimes I make them like just for fun. I got really into the internet through Tumblr. In sort of the late aughts, I had like Facebook and stuff in school, but it wasn't really until I discovered Tumblr that I got like super into like online culture, I guess. That's when I got more into like Reddit too and forums. And when I was popular on Tumblr, there was other people that were sort of popular that were in the internet ecosystem already, like early YouTubers and other bloggers and stuff like that. And so that was kind of my introduction to everything, which I think is a good introduction, because I don't know if you spent a lot of time on Tumblr, but like, just like the level of discourse on Tumblr was so brain poisoned a lot of the time. I think it's like good training ground for the internet as a whole.
I was going to say, I remember Tumblr being, I think it's the only site more insufferable than Reddit was Tumblr.
Yeah. It's probably true. I mean, it's bad. I loved it. I loved it because I loved there wasn't really anything else at that time. Like, Twitter was so young and you could express yourself on Tumblr and you could do it anonymously. Like, that was so crucial. I think this move towards like everyone, you know, every social network, like you have to use your real identity is so harmful. And I'm a blogger. I started as a blogger. I was, you know, like I don't have any formal journalism training. I was very against very against the mainstream media. And that's why I believed in blogging. I was like definitely like drinking the Kool-Aid in terms of all the promise that, you know, it's hard to remember, but like people really thought that like bloggers were going to replace the media, and they kind of, it didn't 100% happen that way. It's not totally wrong, but a lot of bloggers also got absorbed into the traditional media. And I think the traditional media took a lot of learnings from the blog ecosystem, but no, it definitely happened. I mean, that's literally the thesis of my entire book.
See, cause I didn't know this. I didn't know you were Tumblr born.
Oh yeah.
That gives you some cred, right? let me ask you a big picture question. Why do you think on the internet, why do you think liberalism isn't cool anymore?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think part of it is the way the Democratic Party has approached the internet, which is sort of it's disdain. It's funny, in my book, everything about sort of what I wrote in my book of like the rise of this like traditional influencer culture. Like my book is very much about the rise of like influencer culture, as people think of it, as like pop culture. And there is like mentions of this sort of like bizarro right-wing version of it, but the right-wing media was so, and the right-wing internet was so quick, or sort of the right-wing ecosystem was so quick to embrace the internet and influencer culture and meme culture and like sort of the language of the internet. Whereas the Democratic Party has traditionally been very like unable to do that for so many reasons, and traditional media has been so hostile towards that, you know, towards the internet and towards content creators on the internet and individual people. And so I think it kind of like, I think that set the stage. I think also, you know, you have to consider these platforms themselves and what they reward, and what these platforms reward with money and attention and stuff is often inflammatory content. And a lot of that inflammatory content skews to the right because it's like inherently like engaging in some way, you know, because it's like it makes you mad or makes you outraged or whatever. So I think that stuff getting rewarded also, it contributes to success and it sort of normalizes certain ideas online. But I'm not, I don't have like a good answer for that. I think sometimes I wrote a piece on cringe for Rolling Stone. Sometimes I write freelance pieces for on the side. And I wrote a piece on cringe content for Rolling Stone a couple months ago. And I do think that there's an appreciation of like earnestness a little bit now that there wasn't even a couple years ago. But I wouldn't say that it's made liberalism cool in any way online, which I think, I think people want to seem edgy and in touch with culture. And so that you know, that sort of more right-leaning content appeals to them.
I mean, because to me, what maybe the biggest shift in American politics in the last generation is that it's the left that has become the side of respectability. And you know, of trying to depict itself as the moral majority, this sort of thing, all this stuff that used to be the language of the right, we're the silent majority, we're the moral majority, we're for law and order, we're for patriotism, all of this stuff, it's now the left that tries to claim that mantle, but it can't ever quite do it completely because it sort of goes against, you know, the values of, you know, the 1960s left, the boomer hippie countercultural left. They're in this terrible position where they've actually succeeded in taking over a lot of cultural institutions. And then it's hard to maintain your cool card when you do that. And then the right in this bizarro scenario that we're in, then it's the right that becomes the abrasive, the vulgar, the countercultural, but then they can't ever quite do that all the way because, you know, ultimately if you want the society that they claim that they want, that's not very, it's ultimately not very edgy to long for, you know, the super normie world that ultimately they want. So it's pretty schizophrenic, quite frankly. And I'm not sure how it's going to end. The only thing that I try to take some hope in is that maybe in this weird, almost Buddhistic way, we're going to burn off all of this cultural karma and people will just sort of embrace quietism in the future. Maybe that will be the future for Zoomers. They'll get so tired. They will look at the era that we are in now, like, this is like the dopamine crack epidemic, and after it they're going to be so traumatized for it that no one's going to want to be ideological again for at least 50 years.
That would be interesting to, if that happened. I feel like there's too many corporate interests at play that, you know, want to keep us like hooked on the dopamine. But yeah, no, I totally, I agree with you on a lot of that. I mean, I think you're right in sort of how it all evolved, and I have no idea where it's going to go. It's so weird. And like, you know, I'm in my 30s. I have no idea what some teenager, you know, is going to think in like 15 years, but I do think that we are all getting a collective, like starting to get burnout, just in the sense of like, if you look at the platforms that are taking off or have emerged, they're not really a lot of like broadcast based social platforms. Like people are spending a lot more time in Discord and platforms that allow you to like better curate your bubble. I mean, Threads is not like this, but like, you know, a lot of other, like even apps like Be Real taking off or whatever. It's these more contained internet spaces where you're not exposed to the masses or, you know, like getting canceled on Twitter or like posting something that's immediately going to move your, you know, leave your bubble and be taken to a new group. So yeah, I agree.
Predictions for 2024.
Oh God. I think it's going to be a crazy election. What's a prediction? I mean, I think that there's going to be a turning point for Twitter, and I could see, I don't know if this is like, I'm not 100% on this prediction, but I could see Twitter having a revival as we move closer to the election. Like, I think that Twitter's always had a lot of relevance around elections and big news events. I think everyone's hyped on Threads now and everyone's like, this is the end of Twitter. This is the end of Twitter. Who knows what Elon Musk will do, because he's just like inept and makes so many rash decisions. But I could see the election kind of like giving it a boost and, you know, carrying it through the next year.
Yeah, I mean, okay, Elon Musk did cancel you, so you're a little bit
biased. Yeah, he hates me, but you know, he still responds to my emails. So
do you think it's possible that DeSantis is going to be able to meme his way to the White House? Do you think he would, him and his movement could somehow, I mean, as someone such as yourself who's closely studied paid influencers, do you think that, you know, if you were paid to do this, I mean, how might you do it? How might you try to meme DeSantis into at least the GOP nomination?
Yeah, I mean, I think DeSantis has a good internet strategy in some ways. And like, he's very good at sort of like creating outrage and tapping into these viral moments online and weaponizing these platforms for his own, you know, goals. He's just not charismatic. And I do think that ultimately, like, you have to have a certain level of charisma, and he's also short. And I know that people don't care about that, but I do think people care about, like, it's weird. Like, somebody did this like chart of heights of presidents and like how tall they've been, I guess. And like, I think we've like never had a president under, I can't remember what it was, like 5'10" or something. I can't remember how short DeSantis is, but like, I do think that there's some sort of like physical features, because we live in such a visual world. Like, I just don't know if like DeSantis has that like, offline charisma and like the sort of physical presence that people want in a leader. Well, I don't know.
This is what's interesting to me, because it was, you know, the 1960 election, that was the clear line of delineation between, you know, the pre-TV age and the post-TV age in American politics. You know, JFK, Camelot, the fact that you had this picturesque first family was a big deal. It was perfect for the TV age. And it's kind of sad, because, you know, I don't think we've had a bearded president in about 100 years. We certainly haven't had a fat president in about 100 years. I mean, once TV came along, you really couldn't be elected president unless you had a certain look. You didn't have to be great looking, but right. You couldn't be short. You couldn't be fat, this sort of thing. But then I wonder, could we have another media transformation of presidential politics through social media, where it's like, well, if you can't win with looks, you can win with memes. You can win with influencers. You can obscure what you actually look like by becoming a Wojak, this sort of thing, right? This is what I'm imagining a desperate DeSantis campaign, or even a desperate Trump campaign, might be thinking when they start paying influencers.
Yeah, totally. And I think, Trump in some ways did that, although Trump has the charisma and the presence and the height, you know, like, yeah, I think it remains to be seen. I don't know. We're so far out still. I mean, even I remember going into the RNC, which I think was like late June or early July in 2016. And people were still wondering if it would be a contested convention because like it wasn't even, it's like pretty sure that Trump would be the nominee, but it wasn't 100% sure. And so I think like, it's just, there's so much time still until we are really getting down to the wire. And there's so many outside forces that could end up shaping what happens. I mean, I know that, what's his name? RFK is getting like a lot of online hype now. I mean, speaking of which, like for like bench pressing, whatever, did you see that CNN segment where they're just like thirsting over him, like weightlifting?
Swole Camelot.
Yeah.
Chad Camelot has come.
It's so funny, but like, you know, I don't know. There could be these like figures that end up cleaving off enough of the vote that it doesn't matter if DeSantis memes all over, you know, like he's not going to win. I don't know. I don't know. It is kind of terrifying just how like arbitrary all of it can be.
I do also, the funny thing about Kennedy is that he's like very anti-climate change, but he's also anti-vax, or at least COVID vax. So there's like this very specific niche of crunchy granola liberals who he's like perfect for.
Yeah. Oh my God. I know. I have friends that like would die for him already. And I'm like, what? as you said, he appeals to a very specific type of person. And I think he also is good at tapping into this sort of like populist rhetoric that performs very well across partisan lines.
But do you think Biden's making it to 2024?
How old is he? I mean, I guess. I honestly, I think it's worrying that we have people, you know, I think like it would be great to have an age limit on, you know, people in political power. I think it's kind of crazy to me that we have so many people in power in this country that like we wouldn't allow them to be the CEO of Target because we wouldn't, you know, there's corporations that are like, okay, the CEO needs to retire. They're too old. And yet then we let people go run the entire country. I don't know.
He just needs Neuralink. But Biden just needs Neuralink.
Yeah, he needs Neuralink. And then he'll be good to go. I was just saying it's funny that like, I don't know. It's just, it's very, it'll be interesting to see kind of how he performs in the next year. Because I do think, I don't think he has a lot of popularity. I feel like it's like a very, I mean, his approval ratings are so low. I feel like it's constantly what the Democratic Party seems to do in these situations where it's like, okay, like they're sort of putting someone up and being like, well, look at the alternative. Like, I just remember that messaging so hard in 2016. It's like, the alternative is whatever, whatever. And I just don't know how long a political party can last where it's like their main strategy is just like, well, look how bad it could be on the other side, you know?
Yeah, but when you are speaking to a bunch of jobless, alienated, disillusioned young people, the problem with the lesser of two evils is eventually evil starts to sound really cool.
Yeah, 100%.
This is the last thing that I wanted to ask you about, actually, which is, how are you going to make being liberal cool again?
That's an interesting challenge. I feel like there's all these like challenges. That's like one of those articles you'd read in Fast Company where it's like, we hired 10 designers to like rebrand the Democratic Party or whatever, you know?
As someone who, you know, you've written this book extremely online, you've clearly studied how influencers function, how that economy functions, how it works, how they're able to manipulate one idea over another. At this point, I feel like if anybody knows how to make being liberal cool again, it has to be Taylor Lorenz.
Yeah. I know. I'm trying to think what would I do if I was kind of in charge of rebranding? I mean, I think the first thing you have to do is have a compelling message and actually stand for something and give people some popular things. Like, I mean, I don't think it's just a matter of appealing to people on the internet, but it's like, I don't know. I'm trying to think how to like describe it. I think it's like more of a focus on, I'm so sorry. I'm so limited in what I can say because of our policies on stuff that I'm paranoid I'm gonna say the wrong thing and it's gonna be taken out into a Fox News headline, which they love to do. I don't know. I mean, I think that in order to appeal to young people and to make anything cool, you have to have people that are cool embrace something. You have to stand for something interesting, and you can't just be super corporate. I don't know. Am I making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. But what I mean is that that sounds practical, but it doesn't sound very cool.
I know. I think we need, I mean, I just, I think if you want, I think there's certain things that'll always be uncool, but I do think that we need to make it cool to kind of like care about things. And I think like, I do think that we're reaching the end of like, I think everyone was so irony pilled in like 2018 and 2019, especially. And I do think it's like changing a little bit, but I think that you need people to kind of like just call out a lot of bullshit, like, and sort of just show how, like, I mean, so many of these people online that are like, I'm a free thinker, I'm an independent thinker, like, I'm whatever. It's
sure,
like, they're totally programmed. Yeah. But ever, you know, it's like, you're totally programmed by the algorithms that are delivering you, you know, whatever content. But I don't know. I don't have a good, like, one size fits all. I guess I'll launch a political consulting firm, and then someone can pay me $1 million, and I'll come up with a better answer.
I have to tell you, my view is that it's going to be nearly impossible to make liberalism cool again. And you didn't really convince me otherwise.
Fuck. No, I think it's a hard challenge.
I also want to say, okay, if somehow anything you have said on this podcast gets taken out of context and goes into some kind of sensational media cycle, okay, I will go on Fox News in your place, and I will just bark at them about all of my theories about alternative archaeology, lizard people, and psychedelics until they cut me off.
I love it. I will put you up for that. All it's
right,
fine. I think I don't mind when they do stuff like that. It's just crazy. But thank you.
Okay, so liberalism doomed. All right, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a fun combo.
Is there anyone you want to give a shout out to, including yourself? Also, plug the book again so we don't forget.
Yeah, I just want to say pre-order my book. I think you'll find it fascinating. Anyone that spends time online, I think will find it interesting. There's a lot of internet history in there that I think is worth revisiting and talking about. And pre-orders are like the one thing that matters, like for any kind of, like the way they count a book success is like almost all off pre-orders. So I would say if you're interested in reading it at all, just throw a pre-order down, and I promise you, you will not be disappointed.
All right, Taylor, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Oh, wait, can I say one more thing?
Please.
Oh, I was just going to say to follow me on, I'm on Instagram or Threads or TikTok or whatever. I have a YouTube now too. I'm just at Taylor Lorenz everywhere. So.
All right.